After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Welcome to today's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Joe Healy. We are recording this on Thursday, May 27th, in the morning. That timestamp is probably important because, as is always the case here in the final week of the regular season, things change in a hurry. Conference tournaments are underway all across the country. The conferences that are not playing tournaments this year are either getting underway today or tomorrow with their weekend series. There's a bid going to be handed out today on Thursday, the first bid of the week, as the Patriot League tournament wraps up in Lehigh with Army and Lehigh. So there's a lot going on around the country. We're going to try and get to it as best we can, not following our typical preview format, just going to kind of try and talk through some NCAA tournament bubble situation, field construction, all the rest of that. Hit on some of the coaching news around the country as the coaching change season has continued to kick into high gear already. And we will get to some of the bigger stories of the week so far from conference tournaments again around the country. So a lot to get to here on today's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast, which is presented by Rapsodo. Rapsodo has become the industry standard in player performance data. Coaches use Rapsodo data as a measuring stick for player development and evaluation. The Rapsodo National Player Database is a free service that allows you to see how you stack up against your peers and provides a pathway to get discovered by scouts. You can check out the Rapsodo National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national-database. All right, Joe, we're here. There's a lot going on. You're at the Missouri Valley tournament there in Carbondale. An interesting experience, I'm sure. I'm trying to capture as much as I can. Watch all the games from all over the country. It's a wonderful time of year in the college baseball calendar.
Absolutely. It's been so nice to be back at a conference tournament and kind of be back in that atmosphere and talking about, not just with you, but talking with people in the press box and the SIDs and whatnot about, you know, the bubble talk and who's in and who's out and, you know, how will the committee act this year, given that it's a weird season and all of those things. It's been really, really refreshing to be back. And, you know, conference tournament week kind of gives and takes, right? I mean, on one hand, it's great. The volume of games is great. The volume of games that really matter is awesome. On the other hand, though, you know, you're so beholden to things like weather and games that go super long and all of that. And so it is really a grind, even if you're not at a site, because you're just trying to keep up with everything. So it does kind of give and take away. And as we approach this week every year, it's very easy to forget about the more taxing parts of it and just be excited about it, which is great. But boy, does it ever come with kind of a taxing end as well, just trying to not only if you're at a site, but also if you're just trying to keep up with everything.
Yeah, I feel for everyone in Ruston, Conference USA tournament last night. They had some weather, bad weather on Wednesday, and then La Tech and UTSA decided to play a very slow, very long extra inning game that La Tech ultimately won 7-6, which was a very significant win for the Bulldogs. And then there was that wrapped up at like, I don't know, like 11:30 local. And there was still a whole nother game to play. So Southern Miss and Western Kentucky started at, I believe it was 12:15 local time there in Ruston. And it was tidy. Hunter Stanley pitched really well. So they got that one done quickly. And I think they even run ruled it. So they got out of there an inning early. But it was that's a very late night, early morning situation there for the Hilltoppers and Golden Eagles.
Yeah, it was it was kind of a wild scene. I was back in my hotel. You and I were sending Slack messages back and forth at the end of that La Tech game. And, you know, they were talking on the broadcast about how, you know, they were going to, you know, discuss kind of the idea of pushing the game to the next day with the coaches, you know, after the game was over and have that discussion. And it just, you know, it just seems like there's, and this is true, like you're just stuck between such a rock and a hard place in that moment, because you can move the game to another day, but then it really goofs up your schedule, especially when you're trying to get four games in a day. But the alternative is what we got, which was, you know, the game ending at, I think I saw 2:59 local time for that last game, even though it was tidy. You're right. It was eight innings and it was relatively snappy, but ending it almost 3 a.m. is not exactly an ideal situation, especially for the team that, you know, in this case, Western Kentucky, that lost and has to come back in the, you know, not in the morning at least, but in the, you know, in the early afternoon to play again today.
Yeah, it's a rough scene out there. there are no good answers in these four game a day tournaments, especially if they're playing true double elimination like they do in Conference USA. There's very little wiggle room in the schedule, but we're gonna probably get to some of this tournament bracket format talk here later in the show. So we'll save our thoughts on that for now. But Joe, let's talk for a moment about the NCAA tournament construction. And one of the things that everyone's always top of mind this time of year is top eight seeds. Is my team going to be a top eight seed? What do we have to do to become a top eight seed? And this year, it feels like, Joe, that the answer is, if you're not a top eight seed right now in projections, you might not be, because it feels like it's pretty locked in when you're talking about Arkansas, Vanderbilt, Tennessee and Mississippi State from the SEC, Texas and Texas Tech from the Big 12, Arizona as Pac-12 champs, Notre Dame as ACC regular season winners. Those kind of seem like they're going to be the eight. You know, the other contenders are ECU. Well, ECU is already in the losers bracket of the American Conference tournament, and you know, another loss will definitely end their chances, and they're already not amazing. Their RPI has slipped to 12. TCU, which still has a top eight RPI, but has played abysmally this month, and while they did beat Kansas State in their first game, they had to effort really hard to do it. And if TCU were to go out and win the Big 12 tournament, I think that they can go in and take one of those top eight spots, but I don't feel great about their chances of doing so, just given the way that they've been playing. And then Stanford is a little hard to get a read on. Obviously the Pac-12 has no tournament, but they could very well finish second in the Pac-12 ahead of Oregon after beating Oregon last weekend. They closed this weekend against Oregon State, a series win there, combined with the Pac-12, a second place Pac-12 finish, and maybe the Cardinal can get in the mix, and maybe Florida or Ole Miss can still get in the mix if they win the SEC tournament. Ole Miss is not going to win the SEC tournament coming out of the losers bracket with that pitching situation as they go into the weekend. But, you know, Florida has gone off to a 2-0 start, so, you know, we'll see where that takes them. But Joe, to me, these top eight seeds as they are now, I mean, we can talk about their order, but like it probably is the way it is.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. And to your point, I think any movement that we would see would not come from one of those eight seeds falling. It would probably come from someone in the 9-16 doing something this week extraordinary. And
yeah, you got to come get it.
Exactly. Yeah. The teams that are there are probably there regardless at this point. It's going to have to be earned by somebody outside of that group. And that's still on the table. But again, to your point, I mean, the teams that are kind of in that mix have not necessarily had the starts to this week that they would have wanted to have in order to announce that that was something they were going to do. So I'm with you. I think it feels fairly locked in there at the top. It has felt a little like that for a while now with a good number of these teams, but lately with Texas Tech kind of solidifying itself, Mississippi State steadying itself and really getting back to being as consistent as just about anybody in the conference outside of Arkansas, like all of that stuff happening over the last few weeks, I feel really kind of cemented the rest of that top eight. Whereas before, there were a few teams you kind of set your watch to, but we were still looking to fill out the top eight there. And now we've done so. So now it really is kind of a philosophical thing for some of these teams, because, if you're a team like a Tennessee, for example, like winning the SEC tournament might be a big deal for that program, a program that's still trying to get back to being among the elite in the SEC with consistency. So maybe that matters quite a bit, but for the rest of the teams, it is kind of a good question of how much do you push this week, given that the position you're in, versus being, in your best possible physical state for regionals next weekend.
Yeah. And that will lead to a interesting situation tonight on Thursday night. So if you're listening to this on Friday, go find out. I've written about it at baseballamerica.com. You can read about this game. But Arkansas is playing Vanderbilt tonight. And, Dave Van Horn last night did not want to name a starting pitcher. They played first. They didn't know who they were going to play. They're going to play the winner of Ole Miss and Vanderbilt. They knew that. But he didn't name a starting pitcher last night, said it would depend on who they were playing. They, of course, have not played Vanderbilt yet this season, and a lot of us are kind of tipping that as, like, wouldn't that be a great World Series finals? And, like, they should play in Omaha and all the rest of that. Well, do you, at this point, throw Wicklander or not throw Wicklander? Do you throw Copps? Do you not throw Copps tonight to keep Vanderbilt from getting a look at him versus going out and trying to win the SEC tournament? Arkansas has never won the SEC tournament, but they already have their trophy from the SEC this season. They're locked into the number one seed, it sure seems like. So there's just not a whole lot to be played for there unless they just decide that they really want to add to their trophy case, and they have to weigh that versus adding this trophy and how that affects their pursuit of the trophy that matters the most. So that's going to be an interesting one. And Tennessee and Mississippi State already being on the loser's bracket there makes it all the more challenging for them. I don't know how things are going to play out in the SEC, but, just with Florida already being in the winner's bracket, they play Alabama today. Alabama really wants this game in terms of bubble positioning. So it's not like that's an easy game for Florida, but Florida might end up being a little more motivated than the Vanderbilt and Arkansas half of the bracket. So that makes it interesting here as they try and settle some things in Hoover.
Yeah, I mean, put me down for, if you're going to be cagey, like I think that is a moment to be cagey if you're Arkansas. You don't have really anything to, you have a trophy to gain. I don't want to downplay that, but you don't really have much to gain or lose, So if you have a little bit of what you think might be a perceived edge, if you don't give them a look at your best arms, then I would say, go out there and try to get it done without them. Save those bullets, metaphorically speaking there. Most of the time I think that a lot of that talk is kind of like, how much does it really matter? But you know what, if there's not really much to lose here, then I think this is a moment to do it. It doesn't mean you can't use those pitchers tomorrow, it's not like, cause I understand that you don't want them to maybe go so long without throwing. That doesn't mean you can't use them in another spot. So that would, like I said, if you're going to be cagey, I think this is kind of the moment to be that.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't know how much in an era of all the video scouting that gets done, how much benefit it would be for Vanderbilt to see Wicklander or Copps, or for Arkansas to see Kamar Rocker, for one game and then play them again in Omaha. It would probably be of some benefit, but I do think that probably with the amount of video scouting that gets done now, it's less of an issue. But yeah, I think you're right though. Like, there's not a whole lot to be lost here, and potentially something to be gained. So, yeah, I mean, just hold, if you wanted to hold Wicklander and Copps back until tomorrow's game, or Saturday, if they win today, they don't play on Friday. So if you beat Vanderbilt, you know, the trouble, I guess, at that point would be that if you beat Vanderbilt today, there's a chance you see Vanderbilt again later. So you gotta decide how that all shakes out in the bracket. But I would certainly understand it if Arkansas or Vanderbilt made that decision to hold back. I kind of hope they do, actually. I really want to just see this thing play out in Omaha. I don't need it playing out in Hoover when you can always question motivations and stakes and all the rest of that. Like, let's just wait and play this for real when the most is on the line. All right, let's move on here to the NCAA tournament bubble. A lot going on there this week, of course, as teams try to play themselves into the field of 64 and solidify those at-large bids. So we'll get into that here in a second. But first, check this out. All right, Joe, let's get into the bubble. We've talked all season about how this is a soft NCAA tournament bubble. There are a lot of reasons for that. Some of it's the wonky schedules, some of it's, you know, just some down years, whatever the case. We've arrived in the final week. The bubble is still very soft, but it is starting to take more shape. A couple of results in the ACC tournament have kind of helped shape that. Duke has started very well there in Charlotte, continuing their hot streak, and they're looking good. Clemson and Virginia Tech had quiet exits to the ACC tournament, and that wraps up their seasons for them. We'll get into Clemson here a little more in a second. In the SEC tournament, Alabama and Georgia have gotten wins that have been important. LSU lost. They're a very interesting bubble case now as their week is over, and they're just in wait and see mode. Oklahoma and Baylor have gone off to poor starts in the Big 12 tournament. They need to turn it around quickly if they have any hope of playing in the NCAA tournament. So that's the bubble has been difficult to suss out. Some new teams have arrived. Long Beach State has quietly played itself into a position where it might be in the NCAA tournament. They, of course, playing in the Big West, mostly they played a conference only schedule, except that I think they lost a series to COVID. And so they were able to squeeze a series against Pacific into the mix, but basically it's been a Big West only schedule and they're playing very well against the Big West. And they finish against a bad UC Davis this weekend and have a chance to really run their conference record up there. So, good things happening for the Dirtbags. That's something to watch. And we'll see what Iowa does this weekend. They need something at Michigan State to get into the field too, I think. So Joe, what have you made of this strange bubble situation?
I think one of the things that's really interesting to me, maybe you disagree, I don't know, but it seems to me, and we've talked about this phenomenon last week, that there are so many ACC and SEC teams that have been on the bubble this year. It seems like a larger than usual number of teams in those two conferences sitting around the bubble. We've created so many knockout situations in those tournaments. You know, a team like Alabama that was like really like, I guess, on the periphery of the bubble going into the SEC tournament, but clearly was like, if they lose a game, they're obviously clearly done. But now they've played their way back on. You know, Duke was on the bubble. Now as they've played their way on the good side of off of the bubble. But we've got situations like that. You know, of course, we'll see what happens with Louisville and LSU beat Georgia. And so, you know, we've got those kinds of situations happening all over the place that it strikes me that it hasn't felt like there's a whole lot of room for a team like, you know, I'm here at the Valley Tournament. I think about a team like Indiana State. Like, they have a decent game tonight against SIU, tonight, Thursday. But for the most part, you know, okay, if they beat Dallas Baptist, that's maybe a little bit of a win that helps them. But it's hard for them to, short of winning the thing, obviously, it's hard for them to do a lot to help themselves from that standpoint when you've got these major conference teams that kind of are playing each other constantly or constantly having those opportunities. And it does feel a little bit like, and this is the way it is, this is not a lament, this is just an observation, that teams that are a little bit ascendant, like SIU, like Long Beach State, even though Long Beach State has, we've now taken notice, it does feel like those teams maybe are in a position to get elbowed out a little bit more so than normal. It just, maybe there's not as much of an opportunity for those types of teams to help themselves this year because there's so many opportunities for these major conference teams to play against like teams that are also on the bubble.
I mean, I think that's just the nature of college athletics, not just college baseball, but college athletics. And, 2021, but it is pretty noticeable this year when you have like Georgia and LSU going head to head in a game that has play-in like written all over it. Meanwhile, Indiana State has to toil against, you know, good but not like that level of competition over there in the Valley, and you know you have like the entire SoCon field. They've four teams in the SoCon tournament this year. They're all in like the top, Western Carolina just dropped a spot last night. They're all in the top 76 of RPI. So like that is a situation where somebody is really going to help themselves this weekend, but it also is just not going to have the same kind of resonance that's happening elsewhere. And I also think working against some of that is the fact that the Big Ten not having a tournament is eliminating some of the kind of periphery bubble potential in that league, and Conference USA being as settled as it is, and the American being what looks to be a one bid league, although becoming a two bid league if ECU can't figure it out, and the Sun Belt being as bad as it's been, like the places where we would go to for the mid-major bubble teams just have not been as good this season. And so I think a combination of all of the ACC teams being 500 and these traditional mid-major multi-bid leagues, with the exception of CUSA not showing up this year, I think that has led us to this path.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that has been interesting has been those, we have this phenomenon every year, but you know, I think this year there's been a couple of big examples with Long Beach and with Southern Illinois, one that you and I talked about offline. And actually, funny enough, to the extent that RPI matters, they are back to back in RPI right now, 69 and 70. You know, those are always interesting to me because there are certain teams that you kind of put away for a while. Like, I mean, you know this, like there are certain teams that just in your mind, you just kind of like set them aside and you're like, okay, this team's not, you know, wake me up whenever this team is doing something that feels worthy of being in this discussion. And then sometimes it's hard to like really circle back on that. And, you know, SIU is an interesting team to watch here where their case is largely dependent on what other teams do. You mentioned the SoCon tournament and they swept Mercer earlier this year in the middle of that super hot streak that SIU had, where they were looking like a team that, you know, might rip off a Fairfield like run. And that didn't happened that way. They finished 15 and 13 in the Missouri Valley, but that's a Mercer team that's just outside the top 50. And when you combine it with the fact that they have a series win against Indiana State, which is a top 50 RPI, they split with Dallas Baptist in four games. That's top 50 RPI. That's a pretty compelling resume. And, you know, with the, obviously it's a moving target, but if they win that game against Indiana State tonight, suddenly that's a team that's like in the top 60 in RPI. And that becomes a really, really interesting postseason resume, and one that, like, I don't know, a week ago, like I had not even for a single second considered. They also, by the way, if they get that win, they'll have 40 wins overall. And we know in the past, 40 has been a little something of a magic number. We've seen teams, St. John's comes to mind, a St. John's team that didn't necessarily have a lot going for it on paper, had a decent RPI, and then 40 wins, and that kind of put them over the top. And so, you know, you start to look at that resume and you know, in a year when you talk about the bubble being as soft as it is, like there's a lot to like there, and in a way that I did not anticipate liking a lot about what they had to offer.
I think that's fair. The other thing that is notable in this bubble discussion is that
You have East Carolina in the loser's bracket, like I said, in the American tournament. That becomes a two-bid league again. That's going to hurt somebody, because Wichita and Tulane have both played their way out in recent weeks. We talked about that with Tulane, I believe, on Monday. I think we touched on that. And Wichita has really backed up as well. And, you know, so no one else from that conference is in at-large position. But if ECU can't come out of the winner's bracket, somebody's going to get that bid. So that's a situation to watch. And then, Joe, the other big one, big news from yesterday in bubble land, was that Fairfield got upset by Canisius in the Metro Atlantic tournament, the first round of their, or the first game of their championship round. They played quarterfinals last week and are now playing a double elimination four-team tournament to finish it out at Fairfield. So Fairfield loses just its second game of the season. They lose 4-1. And Fairfield, of course, we've talked about it before. They ran off, you know, that huge winning streak to start the season. They've been one of the top teams in terms of RPI all season long, once they got going, really. And they, as a result, have this like really funky resume. And right now they're sitting at 35-2, number three in the RPI. Their RPI barely moved despite that loss yesterday. They dropped one spot ultimately. For a while, they were number four, and then Texas lost. So they dropped all of one spot for losing to Canisius. They're in the loser's bracket. They're at home. If there's any team in the country that can win a conference tournament from the loser's bracket, it is Fairfield. They're playing at home. They dominated that league all season long. But they are also just one loss from being out now. And we've really struggled to grapple with what Fairfield is this season, what their resume is, playing conference only, dominating a conference that is not typically a very good conference at all. What do you make of all of that? And it had just been kind of a, like, I've always known that we might get to this point where we have to determine, like, okay, are they in or are they out as an at-large team? But I was hoping that we would avoid it. I still am hoping that, because it gets messy in a hurry. Before we get into why it gets so messy, Joe, just what did you make of Canisius going on the road and getting one of the biggest upsets of the week?
You know, I kind of had a little bit of a feeling in my gut about this one. I was talking in the press box with somebody yesterday here at the Valley. They were asking me about it. And I said, you know, Fairfield had kind of been playing with fire. Like they came out so hot in the Metro Atlantic. They were really dominating teams, is the point I'm making. And then later in Metro Atlantic play, like I get that you can't keep up that level of intensity all season, even in a shortened season. So you're going to have slip ups. And the fact that they didn't have more slip ups and take more losses is incredible. But they had some scares, and they even had some scares last weekend against Manhattan. They swept that series, but you know they you know got really pushed by the Jaspers, which were not a good team this year. And so I think they had been playing with fire a little bit in a way that maybe didn't go noticed. And so I'm not too surprised they got here, at least in one game. But you're right that if any team is really set up to do that, it's them. I mean, they have the pitching depth to do it, and obviously the belief to do it, and perhaps taking this kind of loss is what they need. But I was definitely not gobsmacked by the fact that they took on a loss here, because it felt like there was a little bit of inevitability based on the way they had been playing coming into the week.
Okay, so now let's work through some of this Fairfield situation if they do need the at-large bid. I wrote about this at baseballamerica.com last night. And my views on this have evolved probably just over the last couple of weeks. They, you know, we can sit here and say RPI doesn't work for a team for a conference playing conference only games. The MAAC is a closed system. RPI is not built for that. It is built to measure teams, to compare teams across regions, across conferences. To do that, it needs inter-region and inter-conference data. If you deprive it of that data, it cannot work properly. It cannot work as it is designed to work. So that number three RPI next to Fairfield's name should come with like 25 asterisks. They just, it can't do what it's being asked to do. Now, that being said, the selection committee has never come away from, never said this year that they are going to treat RPI all that differently. They were given an opportunity in the fall to work through changes to the formula for this year. They declined to do so. They believed that RPI was going to be fine. Well, here we are. It's not fine. But they, you know, Fairfield is going to be in the top 10 in RPI on Selection Monday. There is no way for them not to be right now. And so if they take that second loss here, they get knocked out of the tournament, they're going to be looking at absolute worst, a 35-3 record and a top 10 RPI. I mean, it's just going to be hard to not put a team like that in the field. I don't know whether I think they should or shouldn't be. I mean, I just know that those two data points are going to be very compelling. Also, that they dominated the league, they won the regular season title, all the rest, those are all good things in their favor. What's working against them is going to be just whatever the regional advisory committee says, but I still would kind of expect the Stags to be rated relatively well in such an evaluation. So that's one end of it. And Joe, before I complicate it, just what do you think about everything that would present to the committee?
It's so, we've never had a case like it. I mean, that goes without saying, I guess, but there's just, it's worth repeating that we've just never had to grapple with a case like this. We've had examples of teams that have dominated regular seasons. I mean, how many Bethune-Cookman teams 10 years ago, you know, just absolutely laid waste to the MEAC and were undefeated in the conference play. And they always won the automatic bid, so it was fine. But those teams, we would have never been having this discussion. And so the fact that the schedule has set up this way, and the fact that, let's not downplay to your point, the fact that that RPI is where it is. It's just right, you know, it's hanging out in the top 10 and is going to hang out in the top 10 all season, has added a layer to this that was not there with Bethune-Cookman or Alabama State from whatever it was 5 years ago, what have you. That is adding a layer of complication to it. I'm of the opinion that this is a philosophical thing. I mean, there are reasonable people can disagree here, and this probably will not be a surprising take for me, but I'm just kind of the opinion that back in 2008 or whatever, like I would have wanted Bethune-Cookman in the field if they didn't win the auto bid and they just, you know, basically stumbled in the conference tournament. I want Fairfield in this field if they don't win the Metro Atlantic tournament. And, you know, at the risk of getting a step ahead of you here, like, you know, Jackson State's in a similar place, but I think that's what this NCAA tournament field should be about. And I guess the counter argument is, hey, well then don't play a conference tournament. And that's fair. Certainly I would hear that. But I just think that these are the types of teams in these types of seasons. I want these types of teams and seasons celebrated. And, you know, I don't know that they will in every case. And actually I know they won't in every case. But Fairfield is a unique one, whether it's fair or not. I think that's a team that's going to get consideration. If I were a betting man, I'd say if they get eliminated in the MAC tournament, I think they are going to be in. If I were a betting man, that would be the bet I would make. And I, you know, whether that's fair or not, I don't know. Whether that's good for the future, to the extent that matters, of the tournament selection committee, because that is an interesting precedent to set. I don't know. I'm not smart enough to really suss that out and really predict the future on that. But I would advocate for them being in. And I think, again, if I were a betting man, I think that's the direction it goes.
All right. So let's add another layer of complication to this. Fairfield, 33-1 in the regular season in the Metro. They played no non-conference games. Their RPI is number three. Jackson State, 24-0 in the SWAC in the regular season. They got in the SWAC tournament championship game. They finished the season 33-9 because they did play non-conference games. and they go, or you have to scroll all the way down to find them in RPI at number 121. That really is through no fault of their own. Their non-conference strength of schedule is 11. They played teams like Mercer, Ole Miss, Mississippi State. Their non-conference RPI is 79. Like, again, this is really no fault of their own that they are where they are. But they are where they are because they play in a conference with a bunch of teams that played very poorly in non-conference competition. And that has brought down everyone's RPI, including Jackson State's in that league. So here we have, potentially, if Fairfield takes another loss, you have two teams that dominated their conferences in the regular season. Fairfield taking just one loss, Jackson State going undefeated. The difference being just that Jackson State happened to play in a conference that said, yes, you can play non-conference games this year, and Fairfield played in a conference that said, no, we're going conference only. No judgment on either of those decisions from me here. I'm not trying to say like the Metro really screwed up and they should have played non-conference games or whatever. But what I am here to say is that if the selection committee does not treat Fairfield and Jackson State the same, what you are saying effectively is that the SWAC should have not played a conference tournament. If Fairfield is in, Jackson State is out, not a conference tournament, the SWAC should have played no non-conference games. That's what you're saying if you're saying Fairfield is in, but Jackson State is out. And to me, that's a massive problem because A, that's not in Jackson State's control. It's not in Fairfield's control either that they didn't play non-conference games. It's not a situation like we saw in some places around the country, Hartford, Long Beach State, Cal State Northridge, where the school decided no non-conference games. And those are happening at administrative levels. Those aren't happening at coach levels even. But like, it's not even that situation. This was a conference-wide decision and that Jackson State and Fairfield could not control. And so you have two teams that dominate conferences that are typically among the 3 to 5 worst conferences in the country. We know that. We know what the historical trends in these conferences are. Ordinarily, neither one of them would be sniffing the NCAA tournament. But if you're going to consider Fairfield, I don't see how you can't also consider Jackson State RPI 121 or not, because if you're going to put Fairfield in and not Jackson State, all you're saying is, sorry, Jackson State, you shouldn't have played those non-conference games. And at that point, why does any bottom five conference ever play a non-conference schedule again?
Yeah, I certainly can't. I can't put it any better than that, because I think you and I are in lockstep on that. I think we're coming at it from a little bit different, from a different priors and for different reasons. But I think you and I agree on that point. You know, I come at it just from the point of like, hey, just let these small conference teams in, like they were undefeated, you know. So I don't have much to add there because I think you encapsulate it really, really well. But I guess I will ask, sometimes with current events and news, we talk about, you know, things being whether or not they're a constitutional crisis, you know, like if Fairfield gets in this scenario, whether the committee means to or not, they are setting what could be a precedent. It doesn't have to be a precedent. It could be a one-off, but they set what could be a precedent and what, oh, by the way, will be assumed as a precedent by a lot of people. So would you say if Fairfield gets in and Jackson State doesn't, would you go so far as to say it creates kind of an NCAA baseball selection committee version of a constitutional crisis here? Because, I mean, I think most people will rightly look at it as just like, weird year, one-off, okay, we're moving on. But I do think there is another subset of people, maybe some of whom are in some of these conferences or are coaches of these teams or administrators, who will kind of look at it and go, well, okay, because we know that coaches in particular desperately want getting into the NCAA tournament to become a formula. There are coaches out there who are very good at RPI games. And I grant them that, like, that's part of the deal. You should schedule very smartly. And they do. But the reason why they're doing that is because they want to take out as much uncertainty as they can in their team's NCAA tournament case, as long as their team wins the games necessary to get there. So if you do this, like, there are going to be coaches out there that are like, oh, okay, well, you know, how can we basically do this and minimize our risk? And so that's a long way of me turning it back to you and asking you if you think this, again, is kind of the committee's version of a constitutional crisis with this precedent they could be setting.
You know, I think it's a real problem if you think that these teams playing non-conference games is something that you would want to retain in the sport, because, you know, I don't know that the SWAC would quit playing non-conference games over this. I think that, you know, there are reasons, you know, they're in a part of the country where, you know, you can give your players an opportunity to play in Swayze Field, Duty Noble, Bluebell Park, Alex Box Stadium. And, you know, given those opportunities, I think you're going to want to keep trying to take them. But, you know, if you're the MAAC, if you're the Northeast Conference, and every year you spend thousands and thousands of dollars sending your teams on the road for the first month, 6 weeks, whatever it is of the season, why mess around with that anymore? If this is how it's going to be, like, you can get in the tournament and do all of this, like, why not just expand your conference schedule like the MAAC did this year and just have at it? You know, like, what are you really losing at that point by not playing each other? You know, you're losing something. I don't want to minimize that, but, like, what are you really losing if you can game the RPI system to get to the point where there are four MAAC teams, all four teams that are playing this weekend in the MAAC tournament are in the top 100 of RPI? Like, why, if you're there, why mess around? And, you know, I would guess that if that happened, if this became a permanent thing, then the committee would be forced to address the RPI issue. But at least in the short term, until they did that, I don't know why you would. I don't see the point. If you're the NEC, if you're the MAAC, to mess around with that. So I do think it would be. And look, I'm not here to say that Fairfield and Jackson State both need to be in this tournament. If Fairfield takes one or lost this weekend, you can say neither one of them get in. And I would probably be okay with that, because if you stack up the 34 best teams in the at-large pool, just based on, not on resume, but on, like, talent or eye test or whatever, you're probably not including either one of those teams. But that's not necessarily what the tournament field is about constructing. If it were about that, we would put in 12 to 14 SEC and ACC teams on an annual basis. So, you know, it's a really difficult needle to thread here. There is no good solution for the committee short of Fairfield winning the tournament, because otherwise, if you group Fairfield and Jackson State, on some level, you're saying RPI does not matter because their RPIs are 120 spots apart, basically. So you're saying RPI doesn't matter, which shouldn't be a controversial take this year, but it does add complications to the rest of the field creation if you, in this case, say, well, you know, we took Jackson State at 121. Sorry, guys. Like, we're not considering you, but, like, we did take this sub 100 RPI team. Or, like, at the other end of that, like, yeah, we didn't take a team in the top 10 in RPI. Like, what's your point here? Like, those are challenging decisions to make. Or if you separate them and say yes to Fairfield, no to Jackson State, again, you're creating this incentive for teams to teams and conferences in the future to say, no, non-conference, we don't need it. Like, we're going to play conference only, and we're going to, you know, get the computer numbers as good as we can get them.
You know, I think the one thing we can all understand to be true is that there are no bigger Fairfield fans on this earth this week than the selection committee. Because if they get in, like, okay, then there actually is a real debate about where you seed them. But really, I think even people that don't
that's
think
small
that,
potatoes.
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, they're not creating any crises about or philosophical debates about what the tournament should be if they put them as a two or whatever. So they certainly are hoping that Fairfield does not leave it in their hands when it's all said and done.
Yeah, and I think it'd be really easy to just put them as a three seed and say, like, ah, look at the RPI and the, like, what they did you know, dominating this league, like three seed, like, okay, there have to be three seeds like that every year. Like Northeastern is one of the teams that like Fairfield would be in contention for. And like, they also played a really wonky schedule. Like they didn't go south hardly at all. Like, yeah, they played some non-conference games, but you know, it's, they also didn't play the southern half of their conference at all because the CAA split north and south. So like, what do you make of that? Like, I don't know. So like, at that point, like, I think you just put Fairfield on the three line and just say, eh. But like anything, if they don't win this MAAC tournament, it's going to get complicated in a hurry. All right. So after that Fairfield Jackson State deep dive, Joe, let's flip over to another mid-major conference on the other side of the country, and that's the West Coast Conference. And they are not playing a tournament this year, but they have found themselves in a very interesting situation this weekend with Gonzaga, which is in the top 25 in that shortlist of potential host sites. They're trying to finish off a West Coast Conference title this weekend against San Diego, which is number two in the conference standings and potentially in the at-large conversation themselves, although they have a poor RPI. You know, also they have some work to do, but if they were to beat Gonzaga this weekend, it would be a big deal for USD.
Yeah. It feels like a little bit of, you know, in some ways, I guess maybe it's, I don't know the right word, but in some ways, I guess it's kind of nice for San Diego. Like obviously they'd love to be in a better position because their resume is, their RPI actually is fairly high considering how relatively empty their resume is. And so, I mean, like literally zero top 50 games, not even wins, games. So considering that, like a top 90 RPI is like, that's actually not bad. And they're in position where if they win this series, like they are probably going to be at least force themselves into the discussion. So San Diego has to feel pretty good about that, all things considered. You know, I thought when this series got put back on the schedule, because this was originally a postponed series from earlier this season. And at the time, this series, you and I on the podcast, had actually previewed this series before it got canceled that week. So that's how kind of a late of a decision it was there. And we, you know, it was disappointing because at the time it looked like an absolute banger of a series. You know, San Diego's RPI was up in the 30s or 40s and Gonzaga was right there. And they were both, I think, 14-4 in the league at the time, or so they were tied at the top or virtually tied, whatever. And it has fallen off a little bit because San Diego has tailed off a little bit here. But at the time, I thought Gonzaga was really the one motivating putting that series back on the schedule because it was clear they were building maybe something greater than just an at-large case, maybe a hosting case. And I guess that's still true. Like they are on the outside looking in of hosting right now. So putting anything else on the resume would be helpful. If they sweep it and they really kind of come out at dominating the WCC, like that is a feather in their cap. The RPI would theoretically be helped a little bit, certainly would be hurt. That would be something. But I think now it's shifted to where San Diego obviously really needs it now. I did not anticipate how much they would end up needing it because at the time I didn't realize how much their numbers were going to sag. So the, you know, I don't have a ton of confidence based on the way San Diego's played that they're going to be in this series. Given especially what Gonzaga has to play for in this instance, but they absolutely needed it. It's a last stand situation for San Diego. It's now or never, and that puts a lot of pressure on the series. But on the other hand, considering their resume is pretty light as it is, they have to feel pretty good that, hey, you know, if we win this series, we're probably right back in the mix.
Yeah, I would definitely say that. And, you know, Gonzaga, we don't have as projected host right now, but like they're really close. It's a really hard resume to evaluate. You know, their RPI is just ahead of the CUSA teams. Like it's Gonzaga, Southern Miss, Charlotte, and La Tech is play opens on Thursday. And the resumes probably couldn't be any more disparate outside of the RPIs. Like Gonzaga just doesn't have the same kind of opportunities out in their part of the country that they do in CUSA country. So things look very different in terms of like just overall games against top 50 and 100 opponents. And, you know, dispensation is typically given to teams out west because of that. But at the same time, like, I don't know. it's going to be interesting to see how that shakes out. And Gonzaga can clean that up themselves this weekend with a statement, and perhaps they can push ahead firmly of those CUSA teams. It's the host race at the back end remains very interesting. Old Dominion remains in the mix as a traveling one seed, and you know, there's just a lot of permutations still in play. So Gonzaga needs something this weekend. San Diego needs something this weekend. And oh, by the way, the West Coast Conference title is still in play here. So it just makes for a very interesting overall series here on the final weekend. Probably the most interesting one of all, because remember, the Big Ten is locked up. Nebraska won that last week. Arizona won the Pac-12 last week. And the Big West is not done, but it might as well be. UC Irvine needs just one win or one loss from UCSB, and they win that title. So this is the one where there's probably the most at play of the conferences that aren't playing tournaments. I guess also in the MAC, you know, Central Michigan and Ball State are still duking it out, but you know, and both have at large chances were they to fall short, particularly Ball State. But the at-large chances of San Diego are very real, as are the hosting chances of Gonzaga.
Yeah, for the conference in the WCC, the best scenario is probably San Diego sweeping this series, getting the auto bid, because Gonzaga would still be an at-large team. They obviously would not be hosting.
Well, I guess it depends on whether you think hosting two teams in would be more significant.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I guess that's just a philosophical thing that I guess we won't solve here, but that would be an interesting debate. But yeah, as far as getting the number of teams in, that's the best scenario. But yeah, I mean, there is something to hosting, you know, and having that opportunity. So yeah, certainly interesting there. I hadn't considered that maybe that would be, but yeah, I don't know either way. But so, I mean, just absolutely series of the year in the WCC, and we had to wait a little extra time to get it, but at least we're getting it now.
I mean, no one in the WCC has hosted since USD did, however long ago, right? Like, I don't think I don't remember any of these teams hosting.
Yeah, I think that's right. And part of it is, you know, I think there's been years when maybe Pepperdine would have been in the conversation, but they can't really host, or they can, I guess, but like they, you know, it's a mark
it's
against
complex.
Them. Right. Yeah. It's a mark against them, their home field situation. So there might've been chances where they've definitely, especially when Steve Rodriguez was at the helm, they've definitely had years where they were in the mix. I don't know whether that was before or after San Diego is hosted. I'm not sure the timeline there, but that's certainly part of what hamstrings them there, is that for a long time, their premier team in the conference was not one that the committee was super excited about having host, which is a bummer, because like much about Eddie B. Field Stadium in Malibu is incredible. The actual stadium is not on the list of things.
Yes, that is definitely the truth. So that's a series to watch this weekend. Joe, let's chase down a couple storylines from the week in conference tournaments. One is that Tim Elko is continuing to be superhuman. He tore his ACL, if you recall, six weeks ago now, and he's back. He's hitting home runs. He homered twice in Ole Miss's loss against Vanderbilt on Wednesday night. He has just been phenomenal and is doing it in, like, I really struggle to come up with comparisons. I saw somebody, I think it was Nick Suss, like, but maybe it wasn't, tweet like a Kirk Gibson photo next to a Tim Elko photo. And like, short of that, like I struggle to come up with a comparison, but like Kirk Gibson was doing it just for like a week in the World Series. Tim Elko has now been at this for a few weeks and is hoping to continue for another like month playing on this one knee situation as Ole Miss's DH.
Like, I have to imagine what they've gotten from Tim Elko has to have been like several standard deviations better than what they expected, because, you know, and it still has mostly just been, now he's gotten some like multiple at-bat games and he's running a little bit. It's not, you know, he's not out there going first to third on singles, but like he's moving a little bit. And, you know, early on in this experiment, and that's very much what it was, you know, it was very much like he's going to get one swing basically. And if he doesn't hit it out of the park, he's going to be out essentially. And like,
So it was the Kirk Gibson experience.
Yes. So two things there. One is he has done plenty of hitting it out of the park. So like that part has been true, but also like, you know, like I said, he's running a little bit and he, you know, had a sharp single last night. So I've been amazed. I mean, superhuman is the exact right way to put it. I've just been amazed at what he's been able to do, you know, and not crumple onto the ground in a heap every time he tries to take off. And I understand with a torn ACL, it's more about cutting and not about straight line running. I get it. But still, to not lose your balance running a little bit, you know, and kind of hurting yourself worse is pretty impressive. And I wrote, I forget what I was writing. Maybe it was in a top 25 capsule or something like that, but that, you know, Elko at this stage is not going to be the type of hitter that can carry an offense, but like, maybe I was wrong. I don't know. Like if you hit two home runs against Vanderbilt, like that's pretty much carrying your offense. And, you know, it wasn't enough on that day, but my goodness, like I might be wrong about that, but I was just kind of assuming that we'd be going one at bat at a time here.
Yeah. When he had the injury and they said like, he might not be done for the year, he's going to try and come back, I was like, okay, but like, really though. And he came back faster than I would have even anticipated him trying to come back. And he's come back far better than anyone could have reasonably expected. Definitely myself included on that. And it's been so impressive to watch how that has unfolded. And, you know, I can't imagine the pain he's playing through and all the rest of it, but like just what he's providing to that lineup right now is massive. And, you know, also just the emotional and psychological lift for that team to see a guy who has played so many games in that program, who clearly is very well liked and very well respected, to see him be able to contribute. I just imagine in a locker room setting that has to mean a lot to the Rebs. All right. The other story from conference tournaments so far that I want to touch on, Joe, is Clemson. Clemson is out. Their season is done in the ACC tournament. It has been a disappointing season for Clemson overall. While we did not project them, or we didn't have them in the preseason top 25, you know, there's still Clemson. You still expect them to produce something of a good season. They're just one of the more consistent programs around the country. That did not quite come to pass this season for a variety of reasons, including the ACC scheduling format, but ultimately they finished the season 25 and 27, and they are under 500 for the first time since 1957. That really snuck up on me, that Clemson, like that was on the table for Clemson, because not that long ago they were sweeping Louisville, and you know, things looked up. Things were looking up for the Tigers, but things have really backed up in the few weeks since then. They're out of the tournament race. They're done, and they had one of the worst seasons in you know, in program history, ultimately, which is, you know, kind of crazy that this is where they're at. But if you haven't been under 500 since 1957, I don't know what else to call this season other than, you know, a significant disappointment.
No, I think that's right. And I think the best way to put it is it was just the team just never found consistency at various points of the season. And you mentioned sweeping Louisville. And of course, you know, now Louisville's in a pretty precarious place. But, you know, there were various points of the season when it was like, yeah, Clemson's in, and it felt pretty secure. And then the other points, like now, for example, like they're clearly out, but this hasn't been the only time. Now it's official, but there have been plenty of other times where we thought, like, yes, I don't think this is going to be a postseason team. And it was just constant up and down and up and down. And, you know, there were a number, I mean, you could, and the thing about it is it's not even like, I think the most troubling is not the right word, but like the thing that I think probably makes it most clear as to why that was, is that it's hard to just kind of point to one thing with Clemson this year that A, went really right, and B, went really wrong. Frankly, it's not like this is a team that was just really ravaged by injuries. It's not like it was necessarily a team that, you know, had lost a lot of talent off the previous team, and therefore we kind of expected a little bit of rebuilding. Obviously not very many teams are looking at that from 2020 to 2021, but it just, offensively, you had Caden Grice, and I think that's a huge bright spot. you know, he's a guy you can really kind of build a lineup around, and maybe as he matures, he becomes a little bit more of an impact arm. Certainly has the stuff for that. So that was good. But then the offense behind him was pretty spotty. Pitching staff wise, getting consistent starting pitching was a real problem. You know, they have exactly one starter who started double digit games, which tells you they were like really mixing and matching, trying to find starters that could give them quality. Jeffrey Gilbert was really good out of the bullpen. But outside of that, you know, on the pitching staff, like what were you really looking at, you know, that you felt really, really good about? So just a tough year for Clemson. Like it's just hard to point to what this team was really exceptional at. And that's been the case kind of all along. And they were kind of overcoming some of that. And ultimately it just wasn't enough.
Yeah. It was a surprise to see this happen. I think we had them. I know we had them projected as a tournament team coming into the season. And, you know, sure, we didn't have them in the top 25, but you know, it's Clemson. You figure they'll be in the mix at some point. And, you know, I thought that they had turned a corner at some point recently. Caden Grice really looked like he had turned it on, like, really well. I mean, but he's a freshman and sometimes stuff happens. And, you know, they dealt with some injuries early in the year. It wasn't a case where they dealt with a bunch of injuries in the middle of the season, but they were not fully healthy coming into the year. And I don't know how much that played into anything. You know, sometimes if you're denied your normal preseason, it just takes a really long time to get back up to speed. And I don't know how much that played into it, but, you know, ultimately you would expect Clemson to find a way to finish 500 at least. But they, especially given the nature of this ACC season and the 12 weekend conference schedule, that wound up not happening. And, you know, it's going to be a longer offseason than what they're used to down there. And, you know, we'll see where they go from here. But I like you said, having Grice around, that's a big bright spot. And I think that there are reasons to believe in Clemson going forward. But, you know, this is not going to be a season they're going to be remembering. All right, Joe, let's move on here from the on-field talk here for a second and get to an update on the coaching changes that have happened around the sport. We mentioned on the Monday podcast that Texas A&M had moved on from Rob Childress after 16 seasons. Since then, Utah's Bill Kinnenberg announced his retirement after 18 seasons as the Utes head coach. And Rice fired Matt Braga after 3 seasons as head coach. There have been several other changes, but those are kind of the top line changes at this point. We have gone deep on the Utah job search over at baseballamerica.com. By the time you read this, we might have also gone deep on Rice. That's in progress. But I think both are interesting searches, interesting jobs right now. Utah is one of the hardest jobs in any major conference in the country. They did win the 2016 Pac-12 title in that very strange season there, when the Pac-12, all the powers kind of cratered at once. Not to downplay what Utah did that season. It was a strange season on the West Coast. Nobody hosted out West. It was a weird year. And then, you know, it's been a challenge though to compete in the Pac-12. Joe, you noted that they only have 2 seasons of double digit Pac-12 wins since joining the conference. Most of the time they're winning like less than 8 games in Pac-12 play. Finding a way to get consistently even to, you know, close to 500 in conference play would be a significant move forward for the Utes. And then Rice, you know, given the messy situation when they moved on from Wayne Graham a few years ago, perhaps that was never going to work out well for whoever the new coach was. It certainly didn't work out well for Braga. They're moving on from him after 3 seasons, 2 of which are somewhat pandemic marred. So, I mean, that kind of lets you know the deal there, but it was that was a really tough situation to walk into. And, you know, hopefully for the Owls' sake, they are able to find a little more cohesion, a little more They're able to bring more groups together there, because I just felt like there was so much conflict internally there about what should be done post Wayne Graham, about whether Wayne Graham should have been, you know, whether he should still have been the head coach or not, that it just doesn't seem like it was a particularly great situation for the program. So it would be nice to see a program with the tradition of Rice find its footing a little better, if they can all be pulling the rope in the same direction now.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of always the case when you have a legend going out, and there's not necessarily, and it's clear that the legend wants to stick around and the administration wants to move on, and they're kind of at loggerheads about that. And that's kind of always, and I don't know the intimate details of the situation, but it was pretty clear that, you know, if it wasn't that Wayne Graham still wanted to stick around, it was that maybe Wayne Graham wanted a little more influence in what was happening. And we can argue about how much that should be and what, you know, all that kind of stuff, but it is what it is. And there were some extenuating circumstances with Rice, thought they had some other candidates lined up and that fell through. And so they end up with Braga, and it, you know, it felt like an odd fit from the start. It's tough to argue with Braga's credentials for what they were, you know, building up Tennessee Tech, a program that, you know, I don't mean to be crass about it, but just doesn't have a lot going for it in a lot of ways. And to turn them into the most consistent program in the OVC over a pretty significant period of time, and getting to a daggum super regional for Tennessee Tech. I mean, geez, that sentence itself is incredible. And so you can't really argue with that. And I think, you know, Braga now, you know, I think he'd still be a good fit at a program that he can build in the same way that he built Tennessee Tech. And so, but it just did seem like kind of an odd fit. You know, he hadn't ever, you know, coached in the state of Texas. He hadn't ever really coached at a private, hadn't at all coached at a private school like Rice, you know, highly academic, expensive, all of that kind of stuff. So it just was kind of like, felt like a square peg in a round hole. And it is pretty abrupt, but the thing about it is that, you know, Rice was actually had a fairly veteran team this year, you know, Braden Como, Bradley Knighting, grad transfer and Will Karp, they had some players who were juniors, you know, going into senior years. Like, this wasn't like he was playing with a team full of freshmen. I mean, there were some younger guys that had impacts, Guy Garibay, one of them, a two-way player, but it kind of felt like a deal where if they keep Braga around, like, it wouldn't have really been fair to, it felt like they were in a position where they felt like they needed to either cut bait now, or you were probably going to need to fairly give him another 2 or 3 years, because the roster was going to turn over a decent amount after this season. And so would that have really been, are you in a better or worse place if you give him another year, but next year is kind of similar, because it's now it really is a young team. And that's the question I think Rice had to answer. And I think they decided, you know what, we can't risk it getting any worse. And so we need to cut bait here and try to improve the situation. And we'll see if they were right or not to do that. Obviously we'll just find out based on what the next guy does. Quickly on Utah. I mean, you're right. It's kind of incredible to me that, you know, they had that big 2016 season, and then they were pretty decent in 17. But other than that, like, it's just been a real struggle to be competitive in the Pac-12. And if you look at the history of Utah, that's not a huge surprise. I mean, it's not like that was a team that was running the show in the Mountain West Conference when they moved up. It was basically a 500 team in the Mountain West Conference that got thrown into the Pac-12 for reasons that had nothing to do with baseball. So the fact that Kinneberg had led them to the heights that he led them to, I think, should be a credit to him. But the trick now with Utah, I don't think anybody's in conversations I've had about that job last few days, this has only reaffirmed that, but it's not a job you go into expecting, hey, we're going to become a real player in the Pac-12 year after year. It's about, can we get the valleys in this, the peaks and valleys? If the valleys cannot be, you know, 6-24 in the Pac-12 and can instead be 11-19, while still peaking every 3 to 4 years, that's to me what this hire is going to be more about, less about trying to turn it into some kind of power. Not that Utah wouldn't take that, but it doesn't feel like that's a particularly realistic goal. I think this is just kind of more about mitigating how bad do the bad years get, and trying to keep those from being the types of years where they're just not competitive.
If Utah wants to become a power in the Pac-12, like, I think, first of all, I think it could be done. You're in Salt Lake City, you know, there's things to sell about the job. It would be challenging, but I think it could be done. Like, I mean, let's face it, Oregon State is not in an unchallenging place, and they are one of the Pac-12 powers. But to do so, Utah would have to invest not only in the next coach, but also pretty heavily in everything around the program. This is a team that, you know, shares a ballpark with the AAA team, but it doesn't really, you know, Duke does that, and it's fine because Duke has a great on-field facility that they can practice at. Utah, they don't have what Duke has. So they need to, if Utah were really serious about trying to become a power, they need heavy investment. And I'm sure they know that. But if they just want to be a little more competitive, I think the next coach can do that with, you know, some investment, but, you know, working with some of the things that they have. You know, Kinnenberg did a great job bringing them into the conference. Now the next step is to try and work towards 500 more often than not. And the great thing about being in the Pac-12 and why this job is still going to be relatively attractive is because that if you are in 500 in the Pac-12, you are minimally like on the bubble. And, you know, so that is why, you know, some coaches will be very interested in this job, even knowing the challenges that it presents. So I think they can get a pretty solid coach here. I think Bill Kinnenberg was a really solid coach. It's going to be more about then, like, okay, what do you do to build this further? And what kind of support are you going to get behind the scenes? At Rice, they can go a number of different directions. It's an attractive job. You're seeing what Conference USA is doing this year. That probably only makes things more attractive in Houston. Clearly, though, there's some stuff that they have to work out. And everyone in Houston probably also needs to understand that it's not 2003 anymore. And I'm not saying that they don't understand that, but it is important as they go through this that is an understanding that college baseball has changed. Rice's place in college baseball can still be a very good one, but you know, what happened in 2003, 2004 under Wayne Graham was absolutely special and should be very celebrated, but should not in any way be the standard that Rice is measured against in 2021.
Yeah, I mean, here's a comparison both schools will hate, fans of both schools will hate. You know, we've talked about how with Nebraska, getting to the heights that Dave Van Horn led them to is a tall task that may never be repeated for reasons that have nothing to do with the program or Will Bolt or whoever, but just because of conditions around the sport and the fact that Nebraska is not in the Big 12 anymore. Rice feels pretty similar. The conditions have changed a little bit, which is not to say, by the way, Nebraska still can get to Omaha. Rice can still get to Omaha. Like we see in Conference USA this year, the league can be propped up, but you're right. Like it's we're living in a different world now. And, you know, you have to play, you have to deal with reality on reality's terms. And so that will be, you're right to say that will be important for Rice to understand as they move forward.
Yes. And I feel for Braga. I don't think he got a particularly great shake there, but like I said, it's a challenging situation to walk into, replacing a legend, especially a legend that has left in that situation. I think he'll be a good fit again as a head coach somewhere or as a hitting coach. If he's a great hitting mind, he's been a head coach for a really long time now. So I'm sure he can get another job at that if that's what he's looking for. But if he wants to be a hitting coach, there places would do well. You know, he's going to bring a lot of energy and, you know, the numbers, especially at Tennessee Tech, even if it's an offensive environment, I mean, the numbers were, they speak very well for themselves. So, happy trails to Bill Kinnenberg and hopefully the folks on Braga's staff, Braga and the folks on his staff can find good landing spots as well moving forward. I expect that the coaching changes will only continue to heat up from here, especially early next week as, you know, everyone that played in a conference tournament, their season finishes. I think you're going to see some more changes as we go, and we'll have that all covered for you over at baseballamerica.com. In addition to the fact that on Monday, we will have a field of 64, an official one, not just me projecting the field, but the real one from the selection committee. So we'll have plenty of content involving that over at baseballamerica.com. We'll have another edition of the Baseball America College podcast, which you can find on your favorite podcasting apps. be that Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcasts, you can find us, and we will come back to you on Monday, reacting to the field of 64, probably starting to take a little bit of a look at the field and how we think things might play out. And then throughout next week, again, we'll have plenty of content previewing the NCAA tournament. Until then, though, there's plenty going on over at the website to check out. We have you covered throughout the weekend here leading up to Selection Monday, daily updated projected field of 64, plenty of coverage of what's going on the bubble and beyond in the conference tournaments around the country. So check that out. You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy BA, and you can get our more instant analysis on some of the things happening around the country. Thank you all for listening to this edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. Thank you to Rapsodo for presenting it. For Joe, I'm Teddy. We'll talk to you next time.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.